Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for Is what?
The 72nd Street project, Judge. Because in the 72nd Street project, HUD was not involved in that case. We know there were no fraudulent applications, no fraudulent appraisals. We know that there were no unqualified purchasers in that case. And what occurred, Judge, is when Brunt took the stand and without notice, without an analysis under Rule 404B or Rule 403, he began to tell the jury a assortment of crimes and misdeeds that Murphy had performed.
Okay, but that's not a joinder problem. That's a 403 problem.
Well, Judge,
or 404B problem, right?
I think it is, Judge, and I agree
why?
With you.
Why? But why? You can make a motion 403 or 404B, and wouldn't that take care of it?
But, Judge, we did.
Yes, I know, but he didn't grant the motion. But if he granted the motion, that would take care of the problem without need for severance.
Well, Judge, perhaps that's true. Yes, perhaps the
so
judge.
So if your complaint is his rulings on 4344, that's fine, but that isn't a severance problem.
Well, Judge, it's a joinder problem to the extent that we had to turn over, as the court knows, in advance any, quote, 404B to our co-defendants, which we did very religiously. And what we suffered at trial, Judge, was totally blindsided by 404B evidence, if you will.
Well, not blindsided, because you can object to it, right?
Well, Judge,
before it's introduced.
Yes, yes, that's correct, Judge. And I think the
if he'd granted the motion, you'd be fine. You wouldn't be complaining about severance, right?
Well, Judge, I think that's true. If the judge had granted a severance
right.
at that point,
but then your complaint is about 403, 404B, not about severance.
Judge, it is about 403 and 404B, correct. And I'll take it one step further, Judge, which is that Judge Guzman never conducted any such analysis, even though we were arguing the prejudicial effect of the evidence, even though we were making arguments under 404B and 403 and talking about how we were surprised by these types of events coming before the court and coming in the presence of the jury without notice. So we certainly brought that to the attention of the judge. And Judge Guzman.
No, look, you know, I don't think where you're tracking me. That's fine, and you know, you can complain he erred and it was prejudicial and all that. It's just that it's not an objection to joinder. It's an objection to a ruling on admissibility of evidence.
Okay, Judge, I can understand where you're coming from that on whether the evidence is relevant to the issues in the case. I respectfully would submit, Judge, that first of all, it is a severance joinder issue, but then it does become an admissibility of evidence issue, which, of course, we argued in our brief about 404B and the points and the 403 points that we were trying to make. And yet Judge Guzman did very little about it to nothing about it, Judge. I mean, if you read this record, and of course we've detailed the various specific instances.
So what's the worst piece of evidence that concerning Murphy that you
well,
would
well, I think
to
it's a combination of 72nd Street and McDermott.
We'll focus on 70. Okay, so what's the problem with 72nd Street?
72nd Street occurred several years later, and it involved a construction loan from Prairie State Bank, where Murphy and his partners got their own loan from a bank and were put on the hook for any loss from that bank. And in that instance, Judge, what occurred is Brunt hit the witness stand and stated that there was not a third investor to his knowledge, a guy named Charles Ingalls, who was clearly stated on some promissory notes and things like that. He said that Murphy concealed the fact of Ingalls' interest in the development from him, and it cost him money, it cost him property. He said there was forgery committed by Murphy in doing that, in hiding that investor, that third investor from him. He accused us of submitting false documents in the case, including the government saying some of the documents that have been admitted in the government's case in chief were fraudulent, the things that we were relying on. They introduced a certified trust agreement, which we had never seen before, that contained Murphy's forged signature, very as clear as day. And then, Judge, from there, it branched off into this McDermott matter, which is equally as heinous in this case. And basically, the government took Brunt's, as you know, the 72nd Street property was important for the government because it supported its money laundering charge against Brunt. Because Brunt submitted paperwork that said the work had been completed, he received a draw of $155,000. He took that money and purchased a Rolls Royce. In addition to saying, Judge, that Murphy was complicit in that money laundering because Murphy signed off on those documents, which was false. In addition to that, once the Rolls-Royce was seized, he went to Murphy and said, the IRS took my Rolls-Royce. And he
are you complaining about – you're obviously complaining about the truthfulness of the testimony, but why does that make it inadmissible? Right? The jury can disbelieve Brunt, right?
Because, Judge, it wasn't relevant to the charges in the case. Murphy wasn't charged with any mail fraud or wire fraud violations with respect to the 72nd Street property. The government even conceded in front of Judge Guzman pre-trial that they don't think Murphy did anything wrong with respect to that property. It's Brunt that turned that property around and that evidence around and put it on Murphy, Judge.
So that's your 404B objection, that it's...
Judge, and there's more.
Other bad acts.
Correct, Judge. And let me give you this one, Judge, what I think is equally as bad. When the Rolls-Royce was seized, Murphy referred Brunt to an attorney in his office by the name of Michael McDermott. And when Brunt testified about his representation of Michael McDermott, he basically stated that Murphy was controlling Michael McDermott's actions and judgment, and Brunt was simply following along. So Murphy was the puppet for McDermott, who was telling Brunt and providing Brunt with counsel with respect to his Rolls-Royce. So there's this slew of also ethical violations where he said people who are in Murphy's office, Judge, who are all very respected attorneys, real estate attorneys were corrupt. This other attorney who does civil forfeiture work was corrupt. Judge?
I hope you'll save one moment at least to talk about the leadership enhancement of your client.
Thank you, Judge. I would say, Judge, that Mr. Martin is going to be talking about leadership a little bit more than I was anticipating.
I'm fine to wait.
Okay, but we certainly believe, Judge, that Mr. Murphy should not have been enhanced for a leadership role based on his education and based on the fact that he simply provided funding for this and dictated the terms of the return of the money because it was his investment. And Judge Posner pointed that out in the Weaver case recently. I think we quoted that, a little language from that opinion, which I think is fairly on point.
Okay, well thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
Lightfuller.
Mr. Martin?
May it please the Court, my name is Mark Martin, and I represent the appellant, John Ferrano. Like Mr. Murphy, Mr. Ferrano has raised a severance claim. We recognize that we don't have a right to compel unified defenses among the defendants, but we do have a right, specific trial rights, not to be convicted on the basis of bad character evidence, propensity evidence, or even false evidence.
I don't know what that has to do with severance, though.
Well, the Rule 14 standard is prejudice, and the Rule 404B standard and the Rule 403 standard is also prejudice. And the point is that the evidence about...
Yes, but if you have remedies under other rules like 403 and 404, why do you have to sever?
In this case, the evidence would not have come in if Mr. Ferrano went to trial with just Mr. Murphy or Mr. Murphy and Ms. Skolark.
But if it's admissible evidence, why shouldn't it come in?
It was not admissible evidence.
But if it's inadmissible, then you object to it and it doesn't get in if the judge rules, you know, in your favor.
And that's one remedy, but also under Rule 14.
But I don't understand. That's the proper remedy, right? Because if the evidence is admissible under 403 or 404B, the jury should hear it.
And if it's not admissible, the jury shouldn't hear it. But
yes, and it shouldn't hear it, and that's why you have 403 and 404B and other exclusionary rules.
Right.
I don't know why, if given the exclusionary rules, why do you need the severance?
Because the evidence in this case was brought in by a co-defendant. It wasn't brought in by the government. And if the co-defendant wasn't there with Mr. Ferrano, the evidence wouldn't have been brought in this case. The government would never have brought in a conversation where Mr. Ferrano supposedly said, I don't have to steal from you, and I won't even use the word in the courtroom, and then said, I have he's bragging about stealing, and then he takes it to Mr. Murphy, and then hearsay comes in where Murphy opines that their theft had occurred on the transaction. That evidence would never have come in if Mr. Ferrano went to trial alone. It came in by virtue of the co-defendant.
So what? I don't understand. If it's admissible evidence, we want it in, don't we?
Accusing a defendant of using that kind of language.
But that happens all the time, right? I mean, what if Brunt had made a deal with the government to be a cooperative witness, a cooperating witness, and then he'd testify, and you'd have a co-defendant testifying against, you know, a defendant.
And we would not have had Brunt's attorney, whose mission in this case was to see that Mr. Ferrano got convicted.
I don't understand. If Brunt testified for the government, he made a deal with the government, gets a lighter sentence in exchange for testifying against Ferrano, and he testifies. How is that any different from what happened here?
Well, for two reasons. One, as I just mentioned, is Brunt had an attorney in this case whose cross-examinations were more focused on trying to destroy Ferrano than they were to advance
any... Yes, I know, but if Brunt were testifying for the government would be using Brunt to try to destroy Ferrano.
But in this case, the government called an appraiser. The appraiser did not mention Mr. Ferrano. But Brunt, when he testified, tried to make it look
like... You're missing my point. If the government made a deal with Brunt and Brunt testified for the government, he'd be saying all these the exact same things.
But not in the circumstances of this case, because what I'm trying to point out is that other witnesses testified, government witnesses who had plea agreements testified that were inconsistent with Mr. Brunt.
That's fine. That helps you.
Well, the government's not going to put
out... Look, I don't know. I think you're missing something fundamental. If Brunt testified for the government, he made a deal with the government, he would be saying essentially the same things, and you'd be objecting, and there'd be other evidence and so on. I just don't see what difference the joinder makes.
He wouldn't be saying the same things. For instance, Your Honor, in this
case,
Mr. Brunt, the indictment charged that Mr. Ferrano loaned Mr. Brunt the money, that Mr. Brunt, through his company, purchased these properties and sold these properties. That's what the indictment charged. The government's own charts had the caption, amount loaned by Ferrano to Brunt. But Brunt, when he testified and when his lawyers cross-examined the witnesses, repeatedly insisted, no, there was no loan arrangement here. There was no credit arrangement. I didn't purchase these properties. I was just a rehabber. So Brunt, I don't know how the government could have put him on. It would have been inconsistent with its theory of prosecution as set forth in the indictment. It would be inconsistent with its other witnesses.
But you're saying it was inconsistent, right? Brunt testifies, and you say his testimony is inconsistent with the government's theory. Well, that would be equally true if he were the government's witness, right?
But the government, if it takes a position in the grand jury and gets a sworn indictment that this is a credit arrangement, and then its witness does not support that, and it knows its witness is giving false testimony about it being a loan arrangement, the government couldn't put that witness on. If the appraiser and the loan officer who testify, we didn't have any illegal dealings with Mr. Ferrano, and they have a plea agreement to tell the truth, and Mr. Brunt is saying things contrary.
Isn't your argument that Brunt's testimony was inadmissible?
Brunt's testimony was prejudicial, inadmissible, yes.
It's inadmissible whether it's one trial or four trials.
Well, that's true, but...
See, I have the same problem I have with Mr. Lipuma. It seems to me the rules of evidence give you protection against certain types of testimony. And that's true whether a person is testifying in a trial solely of your client or whether you've got a joinder of several defendants.
The rules of evidence do give protection against prejudicial evidence. They do give protection
against
rules of
evidence. Right, so then why do you need the severance for additional?
But the rules of criminal procedure also give protection against being joined with the defendant.
But what is the harm of joinder to a defendant beyond the fact that a co-defendant may give inadmissible testimony?
Because that compromises a defendant's specific
trial. But it's inadmissible, right?
But it
should be arguing that the judge failed to exclude inadmissible evidence, not that he failed to sever.
Well, the motions were made for severance. They were renewed, and it came in through the defendant. So it does come in through joinder. There might be another route, but the point is it's the joinder that prejudiced Mr. Ferrano. And the problem here is propensity evidence is precluded because it compromises a jury's ability to give a fair determination.
No, that's fine. That's 404B. So you have that.
Right, but it was brought in by the co-defendant.
But
it wasn't brought in by
what? Why is that important? That it's brought in by a co-defendant rather than by a prosecution witness?
Because if Mr. Ferrano had gone to trial, say with just Mr. Murphy, that evidence would not have brought in. He would have been painted as this wealthy, corrupt, unethical.
Why not? If the evidence hurt you and hurt Murphy, why wouldn't the government have made a deal with Brunt and he would testify as a government witness?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm not going to repeat, but that would be inconsistent with the government's theory of prosecution. And at some point, they would be putting on evidence that they knew wasn't true.
Your approach is a belt and suspenders approach.
Yes, belt and suspenders. I did raise issues with respect to loss in our
right.
Mr. Ferrano's case. If the court looks at the findings here, the district court respectfully glossed over the loss amount. Mr. Ferrano was acquitted of three counts where he involved himself in representing Mr. Murphy at a closing. Yet he was held liable for the losses on those counts.
And that's disputed, is it not, between you and the government, as to whether the judge did take into consideration the counts upon which your client was acquitted?
Well, it's not disputed because what happened was the judge originally was going to hold Mr. Ferrano liable for all the losses associated with the Murphy accounts. And then he said, well, you know what, I'll back out the three acquitted counts. But there were still many other transactions which were enough to bring the amount over to $1 million mark involving Murphy and Ferrano. And it's our position that judges had to make more findings here that Mr. Ferrano was corruptly involved in these transactions.
Inadequacy of the findings.
Inadequacy of the findings is the issue. And then on the leadership role, I think this case is more notable for what Mr. Ferrano did not do. He did not recruit buyers. He did not find properties. He did not.
Who was the leader, or was there not a leader?
Mr. Brunt certainly was a leader, and he didn't get leadership points. He didn't put together loan packages. He didn't work with appraisers. He didn't manage properties. He didn't conduct rehab. He didn't invest with Mr. Murphy. He was a closing attorney with Mr. Murphy. And under the facts of this case, we don't think he's a leader. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Martin. Mr. Mullins?
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Mullins, and I represent Robert Brunt in this action. We are going to focus on, or we intend to focus on, Mr. Brunt's argument that he was denied his right to confront Walter Jackson with a statement that Mr. Jackson had made to police in Richton Park, Illinois.
How could that be important?
It is important, we believe.
How could Brunt have been acquitted?
Well, I think the government itself described the appraisal, the scheme to submit false appraisals, as one of the most critical parts of the scheme. And the primary witness who testified about false appraisals was Walter Jackson. He submitted 20 to 30 appraisals, as opposed to the other appraiser who testified, Mr. Fletcher, who only submitted 2 appraisals. So I think the government itself describes the appraisals as a critical part of the scheme, and Mr. Jackson is the primary witness for this critical part of the scheme. So his credibility is essential to Mr. Brunt's defense, and we believe that the evidence of his statement to law enforcement affected his credibility in 2 respects. One is that he admitted to conduct which showed a character for untruthfulness by assuming another person's identity and by submitting false documents.
Well, sir, I know, but you can point that out to the jury, can't you?
Well, the general fact of his convictions was pointed out, that he was convicted of identity theft and convicted of fraud and forgery, I believe. The underlying facts supporting those convictions was not pointed out because...
Yeah, I know, but if you have a witness who's, who's been, you know, who's engaged in fraud and so on, and isn't that enough to damage that person's credibility very seriously?
I think his credibility was damaged, but I think given the similarity between his prior conduct and the conduct that he accused Mr. Brunt was encouraging him to perform in this case, which was submitting false appraisals, I think getting those underlying facts out was essential to Brunt's defense, and Mr. Brunt was not able to do that because Mr. Jackson denied the allegations on cross-examination.
To me, the more details you have about Jackson, the harder it is on Brunt. He's dealing with this guy who's done the same thing before. How does that help him show that?
Well, Brunt's testimony was that he was not really involved with the appraisal process, that he was primarily
there.
He's
involved with Jackson, and Jackson, you want to bring out all this evidence about his involvement with phony appraisals.
Well, Brunt's testimony was that he didn't necessarily choose Jackson. Jackson was one of the appraisers that was brought on.
Well, that sure doesn't sound like a persuasive argument to a jury.
Well, there was conflicting testimony as to who brought in Jackson. Jackson and Brunt's testimony.
Yes, who brought it in. Brunt is dealing with this person, and you want to show that Jackson engaged in the identical conduct at other times, and that helps Brunt?
We think it does help Brunt because there's no evidence that Brunt knew that Jackson was engaged in any other conduct. And we believe...
So why do you want to bring out... I don't care. So what good does it do you to bring out the other conduct?
Well, Jackson's testimony was that Brunt encouraged him to submit false appraisals by falsifying information on the appraisals and then also by submitting a false name. And Brunt's defense was that he had nothing to do with any appraisals, that he was the rehabber.
Yeah, but you showed that he's a crook, right?
Mr. Jackson. We think that was
right.
Shown, but the similarity, and here's why I think it's important, is that at the same time that Mr. Jackson claimed that Mr. Brunt was encouraging him to submit false appraisals, he was on his own submitting false information to acquire real
estate. Is this the only thing you have? Is this the only point you can make for Brunt? This is not an acquittal point.
Well, our other argument is that Brunt's proffer was brought in, and the government did not establish that his proffer was inconsistent with the testimony that he provided at trial. And this also goes to Mr. Jackson's testimony, because the proffer said that Walt will work with you, and Brunt testified that what Brunt testified to was that he did not know that Jackson was submitting false appraisals. He had prior given a proffer that said he said to law enforcement, Walt will work with you. And the government's theory was that this meant that Brunt knew that Jackson was willing to submit false appraisals. Brunt argued that, in fact, that he did not intend this, meaning that his meaning was that Jackson would not have to get paid up front, that he was willing to take payment later. And the district court wanted the government to clarify, or required the government to clarify, that, in fact, Brunt meant that he knew Jackson would submit false appraisals, and that was not the agent's interpretation of his statement. And the district court allowed the government to cross-examine Brunt with his proffer on the condition that it would establish that that was the law enforcement's understanding of Brunt's statement. The government did not perfect its impeachment of Mr. Brunt in this regard, because it never called the law enforcement agent as a witness. So I think these two issues, again, call into question Walter Jackson's credibility and Brunt's defense with respect to Jackson, which we are arguing establishes cumulative error. If on their own the errors do not amount to an acquittal, together we believe that they could establish cumulative error, because they both go to this critical issue of the appraisals. And other than the appraisals, the evidence against Mr. Brunt was not nearly as black and white as the appraisals. And this goes to harmless error. The evidence of Mr. Brunt's dealings with the buyers of the properties was mixed. Certainly there were many buyers who were unhappy, but there were some buyers who were satisfied. One buyer described the rehab that Mr. Brunt performed as immaculate. HUD did approve certain housing for Section 8 occupancy. So the evidence was much more gray with respect to the alleged fraud against the buyers than it was with respect to the fraud in the appraisals. And Mr. Brunt did not have active participation in the scheme to defraud HUD. He was not accused of providing payments to HUD. So really, the main participation in the scheme for Mr. Brunt in many ways was his dealings with Mr. Jackson.
So you know about the defrauding of HUD?
The evidence that Brunt was, there wasn't a lot of evidence that Brunt was connected with the fraud against HUD, at least as far as documentation. And I will reserve the rest
of
my time.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins. Ms. Garst?
May it please the Court, my name is Hannah Garst. I represent Tracy Skullerk, and I'm going to be speaking about the defendant's sentencing issues with regard to loss and restitution. Two questions that I'd like to discuss today is whether the government proved that HUD suffered an actual loss, and whether the new banks who refinanced the properties suffered a loss as a result of the scheme. These two questions of loss, it increased the defendant's offense levels, both on loss, victims, and then ultimately affected the restitution award. Now, as far as HUD is concerned, we do not believe that the government proved actual loss. Now, clearly HUD's policies and goals were thwarted by the scheme where Westwood acted as a front for these. But that did not equate to monetary loss. And I believe if you look at Belinda Robinson's testimony at trial, she testified that all of the properties were available to nonprofit organizations at the same price. There was no testimony regarding whether or not these would actually go public. The government never asked. And so that wasn't even before the court. All we knew is that these properties were offered to qualified nonprofit organizations, which Westwood was a qualified nonprofit organization, at the exact same price. The price was based on location, not by buyer. Now, even when Skullerk and Murphy objected at sentencing to this loss being included, again, the government put forward no evidence. They merely stated HUD had an actual loss. At sentencing, I think it's helpful to look at what the district court actually did, and it's especially true in
well, HUD was defrauded. You're saying there was no money loss because they would have been in the same financial situation?
Correct. That it wasn't a monetary loss. Now, could it have possibly been an intended loss? The defendants intended to cause a loss to HUD? Well, that could have been argued by the government. They didn't do so. The government all along put forward an actual loss case, which is why they had to prove that HUD suffered some sort of monetary loss. And in this case, when you have a nonprofit purchasing it for exactly the same price as what any nonprofit could.
But are you arguing something different from money is stolen from someone, but he would have lost it anyway?
Well, no, that's not what we're arguing, because there wasn't a loss. I mean, to HUD, they didn't lose any money in this because there was no evidence that these properties would have ever gone for a higher amount. If there was evidence that said in 4 weeks, in 8 weeks, this could have gone to the public at a higher amount, and you had Belinda Robinson testifying and saying, you know, there wasn't many nonprofits out there even looking at these properties, it most likely would have gone.
I didn't hear you. That what?
That there wasn't many nonprofits scooping up these properties, which this was when properties were flying off the market. There's no evidence. There's no evidence. And I think the district court in Murphy, when it was talking about based on the evidence before it, I have no idea what HUD would have done with these properties. I have no idea whether there was an actual loss here based on the record. And the district court seemed to say it would have been impossible for the government to prove that. But that's not the case. If the government wants to put forward an actual loss case, then they need to show the monetary loss to HUD. And even at sentencing, there were no documents put in from HUD. There was nothing to show that there was any sort of actual loss. Now, as far as the refinanced properties.
In other words, your actual loss would show they could have sold it for more had they waited.
Well, there was no evidence of that.
Right. But that's
what
they could
have shown.
That's what you would. It's necessary. That's what you would require.
Well, that's right. That's what the government would have had to show, that there would have been some sort of monetary loss to HUD, not just a general statement that, oh, well, they gave it to the same price that any other nonprofit. So because there was a discount, then that amounted to the loss. Now, as far as the refinance properties.
Well, what percentage of properties do they give to?
It ranged from 10% to 30%, and it was based on the zip code and location of the property.
So was there so if you average that and say discounted by 20%, would that be satisfactory?
You mean if that's what the HUD put forward, the evidence that the
if HUD. If 10 to 30% of its properties are given away basically to nonprofits, right, then the rest are sold.
Oh, I'm sorry. The 10 to 30% was the actual discount on the property. I have no idea how many of these were sold to nonprofits versus the public.
And you say there's no evidence of that?
No, not to my knowledge.
How did the discount work?
How did it work? My understanding is that there was a catalog that was published by HUD or some sort of handout that they would give out to the nonprofits. The nonprofits could go around and look at the properties, and it would show what the price was for nonprofits. Anyone could pick those up. Anyone could go around and see them. But the properties were not available to the public. They were only available to the nonprofit organizations at that time.
But, okay. And nonprofit being defined by?
You had to be approved by HUD, which Westwood was. Now, the refinance properties, we say that there's no actual loss to the new banks that refinance these properties. And although the government cited Miller, United States versus Miller, for this, intervening acts by victims or third parties do not mitigate loss, I think there are several properties that illustrate why this case is way beyond Miller. And that's the 704 East Bowen and the 7927 South Perry. And in those two cases, they were also, the actual loss that the district court found also applied to victims. And these two properties are specifically important for Skullerk and Brunt because it was used to increase the offense level by two because the district court found 10 or more victims. Now, if you look at these two properties, Bank of America was the third bank to refinance. Every single refinance was for more amount, was for a higher mortgage than the one preceding it. Same with the South Perry property. South Central Bank was the second bank to refinance that property. Both of the foreclosure and the deed that was eventually sold to the bank occurred 7 years after the original mortgage was paid off. And we believe that the refinancing cut off the liability to the defendants to find actual loss to these banks. Who
Vance was 7 years after it was paid off?
The original mortgage occurred 7 years before
the original mortgage.
The original mortgage. The scheme was even before that, the end of the, or when this occurred in the scheme. And as far as the restitution, in our reply, the government, we said that the government failed to respond to our argument that these new banks were not victims under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act. I just want to correct for the court, that was a mistake. The government, excuse me, did reply. It's page 95 of their brief. However, our argument still stands that they really didn't respond because in a two-paragraph response, one of which was basic law, they pointed and said, well, we're relying on our loss argument for why that these new banks should be included in restitution. The problem is that there's a different causation standard for loss and restitution. For loss, you can have an intervening cause, which we've talked about under Miller in some circumstances. Restitution, you cannot. Congress clearly stated that if there's a problem with causation and intervening causes, mandatory restitution is not the place to figure that out. And this court has said in United States versus Vaknin that the government must show that loss wouldn't have occurred but for the scheme and that the causal nexus between the conduct and the loss is not too attenuated both factually and in time. And if you look at these banks, that's the problem, is that they're too attenuated both in fact and in time. They're not just third parties. They're fourth parties, fifth parties, sixth parties. And still, the district court is finding actual loss and including them in a restitution order.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Farris.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Yona?
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jason Yonan, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start by addressing the severance issue. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it found that the defendants suffered no actual prejudice as a result of the joint trial in this case. And what I really want to emphasize is the amount of times the district court considered this issue. The district court considered the severance issue pre-trial, based on pre-trial motions filed by several of the defendants. In a written opinion, the district court acknowledged that there was a risk of prejudice in this case and in any joint trial where there's co-defendants. But what the district court found was that that risk can be minimized and that the overall benefits of a joint trial were prevailed over any risk of prejudice to these defendants.
Well, what's troublesome, though, is when you have this kind of joint, you end up with a 9-week trial, and you can't get a good jury for a 9-week trial.
Well, I agree with you that the trial was longer because of the severance, Your Honor. I disagree with you that you couldn't get a good jury for this.
I don't understand that. How can you can't get a person with a responsible job to take 9 weeks off.
Well, I think the jury's verdict in this case shows that
Who are the jurors? Do you get any sort of, responsibly employed people?
I think they were, Your Honor. I absolutely.
Well, but it's someone who had an upper middle class job is not going to take 9 weeks off.
I think there were people with upper.
Well, who were they? What would be your most educated or most economically sophisticated juror?
I can go back, Your Honor, and look and see on the jury selection and submit something to the court post trial.
No,
I don't know. I don't have that information.
Yeah, no. If you don't remember, it's okay. I mean, this is a case. This case probably not that complicated, but it does involve financial transactions and mortgages and dealing with HUD and refinancing. How many people understand refinancing, right? So you'd really like to have an educated jury or some educated jurors, and the longer the trial, the more difficult it is to get people like that.
But I do believe, Your Honor, that they were educated, and I do believe that they attentively sat through the case, and if you look, they deliberated for parts of 7 days. They made decisions about, they acquitted one defendant, they acquitted some defendants of some counts in
right. No, those are good points.
I do think that this jury was attentive to the case. There were facts and circumstances here that were difficult to understand, which you've identified, but I don't believe that deprived them I don't believe that was a reason to sever the case, Your Honor.
Well, the government does have some propensity to want to try a great number of defendants in one trial, though.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
These people. So Brunt, is Brunt the sort of person? Suppose you'd made a deal with Brunt. Would you want him as a prosecution witness in this case?
Well, I mean, we didn't make a deal. No, I mean, yes, Your Honor. There was evidence that Brunt could have brought to the table for the government that would have been helpful. So would we have wanted him as a government witness? Sure, we would have wanted
But his testimony was helpful to the government, wasn't it?
There were aspects of his testimony when he testified that was helpful to the government. That's correct. But, it's not like the government stood up there and paraded Brunt and said, look at what he said. This is how you convict these individuals. I mean, did we point to certain situations where Brunt was corroborated by the evidence? I'm sure we did. But we also did take the position in front of the jury that Mr. Brunt was not telling the truth. In particular, he wasn't telling the truth when he said, I didn't know that the appraisals falsely listed that these properties were fully rehabbed. There wasn't any question the government's position was that he was not telling the truth in that respect. I want to briefly address the 72nd Street property that Mr. LaPuma addressed in his before the court. Mr. LaPuma is correct that Mr. Murphy was not charged in any wrongdoing in that transaction. That transaction was a money laundering count against Robert Brunt. He was alleged to have made false statements.
Is this about the 72nd Street property?
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So Mr. Brunt was alleged to have made false statements to a bank in order to obtain draws on a construction loan. Mr. Murphy wasn't charged in that count. The government didn't argue that he was responsible for that fraudulent conduct. Separate and apart from the fraud involving Brunt, which Murphy was not involved in, that transaction did have some relevance as to Murphy. In particular, as the district court found, in particular, Murphy testified. And one of the things that he testified about was, I'm unsophisticated in real estate transactions. Now, the fact of the matter is this 72nd Street property, even though it occurred after the core set of transactions that the government presented evidence on, it still occurred in the time period alleged that's part of the scheme, because the government alleged there was acts of concealment that took place in 2006. And this was a sophisticated transaction. It was a multi-unit condo conversion where Brunt and Murphy had to go and get a construction loan, and they were paid incrementally based on the work that was completed. That was completely different than the character of the transactions they engaged in before. So it tends to rebut his suggestion that he's unsophisticated in real estate transactions. And it's also fair for the government to argue and to ask Murphy questions, which it did, to the extent that when you did it the right way, when you went and you got a construction loan and you were paid based on the rehab that you completed, you lost money. When you did it the wrong way, which is you get paid first, you take all the risk out of rehabbing a property, you make money every time. That's fair game. The questions the government asked about the 72nd Street property were fair game. Now, this notion about whether this third party was a partner or not frankly, is completely irrelevant. It had nothing to do with the trial. It could have and should have been objected to. Now, Mr. Murphy's counsel did object to the 72nd Street property, but the government had no stake in that. It was ultimately irrelevant to the issues that were going to be resolved at trial. And it was in no way prejudicial because it just didn't have anything to do with anything. It was a dispute between Brunt and Murphy about whether this third party was involved in this property. It didn't have anything to do with the facts of the case.
Now, Brunt and Murphy are the two leaders, or the two people?
The district court found that Brunt and Ferrano were the two leaders.
Brunt and Ferrano. Brunt and Ferrano. Now, but I don't understand.
Your Honor. And Ferrano. I apologize. Murphy and Ferrano were the leaders.
Oh, Brunt was not a leader.
Your Honor. It was Murphy and Ferrano. I apologize.
Okay, so I don't understand. How are they picked out? It doesn't seem to be a very organized fraud with someone giving orders to other people.
It's not that type of fraud, but I think what the district court pointed out was the aspects of the transactions that those two individuals, the lawyers, controlled. And that was, first of all, they're funding the transactions. They're making the decision to engage in these transactions with their money. With respect to Ferrano, he's the seller, he's the attorney on the transaction. He's structuring these transactions in a certain way. He's the one responsible for putting together the seller side of the HUD-1 settlement statement. He's the one who's choosing to go forward into the transaction with his money. With respect to Murphy, I mean, the district court pointed to, I think, very specific aspects of the scheme that showed that he was a leader and organizer. There was a buyer named Robert Ellis who, at the closing, approached Brunt and was basically concerned because the property that he was buying had not yet been rehabbed. And as the district court found, what did Brunt do when that person confronted him? He took him to the leader. He took him to Charles Murphy. And Murphy entered into an agreement with that buyer to rehab the property, to use the money funded by the lender to actually rehab the property.
You read our cases as requiring that that the government show that the defendant controlled a particular person?
I do read him that way, and I do think that's supported in this record, Your Honor. I think it shows that he's controlling Brunt necessarily. When Brunt has to go, when this buyer raises this issue, Brunt has to go to Murphy.
Do you think this requirement of controlling a person applies whether the government's relying on the person being a leader or whether the government is relying on the person being an organizer? It's disjunctive in the guidance.
To the extent it's being an organizer, I don't think it requires actual control. I think leading someone is the actual control. To the extent they're organizing it, Your Honor, I wouldn't take the position that they actually have to control someone else if they're organizing the nuts and bolts of the transaction of the scheme.
First, it's a terrible jumble of a rule, of a statute. But organizer is ambiguous, because organizer could be the person who started it, right? Organized, the founder. But it could also be someone who sort of organizes their day-to-day activities. You're not interested in who founded this, are you?
No.
But so Brunt is just the rehabber, you're saying. Is that the idea?
He's not
subordinate, because he's... Is that the notion, or did he... Or does he have other duties?
He does have other duties, Your Honor.
Because there are all these appraisers, the little people, I suppose, right? So who is managing them, hiring them and assigning them and so on?
It essentially is Brunt who is going out and finding the appraisers and asking them to complete false appraisals. There was also testimony at trial that Skullerk was involved in advising the appraisers as to what these properties should come in at.
Who found the customers, the buyers?
That would be Skullerk and that would be Brunt, were the individuals who found the buyers and who made false statements to the buyers.
So why are they not leaders also? I don't understand. You have plenty of little people, don't you, to get up to your five? So why isn't it they're organizing different aspects? Let me ask, did Brunner or Skullerk, did they get any enhancement for managing, leading that Because it's a nebulous standard.
They got nothing.
Okay, so somehow Murphy and Ferrano have been singled out, and yet couldn't one say Ferrano and Murphy are the organizers of the transactions, the financial transactions? But when it comes to dealing with suckers and also doing the actual rehabilitation so far as it was done, there the organizers are Skullark and Brunt. Why wouldn't that be?
Then
you end up with four leaders.
I think you could say that, Your Honor. I think the district court took a broader view of it, which was who are the ones, which is the first part of what you said, who are the ones that are organizing these specific transactions? And there are other aspects of Murphy's relationship with Brunt that I think the district court found persuasive to show that Murphy was
the transaction. That's the culmination of the fraud. But to get there, you need the you need the rehabber and you need the appraisers. So, why that isn't important also?
I think it is, but I think that what the district court's focus was on.
Did you ask for more leadership enhancements?
For Mr. Brunt, in our government's version of the offense, we did not. And then the probation officer took the position that he should get a leadership enhancement, which the government then agreed with and sought before the district court and was denied.
I see. Yeah.
With Skullark, we did not seek it in the government's version. The district court, the probation officer did think it applied. The government disagreed that it applied against Skullark, and then and the district court did not apply it against Skullark.
What was the district judge's reason for turning down Brunt as a leader?
I think the district court, it was not entirely clear who was controlling one another with respect to Brunt and Skullark, and how the delineation of who was recruiting and who wasn't. I mean, the district court's view, they were essentially working together, and they were sort of one and the same, and it was not a fair way to just impose it against both of them. I think the district court took a broader view and was looking at who's funding the transactions. Who's Robert Brunt going to when he needs money to pay the loan officer, Armani Diafala? He's going to Charles Murphy. When these checks are being cut to Brunt and Skullark's company, which is called Genesis Investments, they're being deposited into Charles Murphy's account. And Charles Murphy is then writing checks to Brunt and Skullark. Who's keeping the notes of the transactions, down sometimes to the penny, determining how much should go to rehab, how much should not? That was Charles Murphy. So I think the district court took that broader view and said, who are the ones organizing and leading these transactions? It's the educated lawyers who are doing it. The Brunt and Skullark in some ways were looked at more of the henchmen, the people going out there and finding the appraisals, going out there and finding the buyers, the people who are executing the scheme on the behalf of the individuals funding it.
There had to be some point at which the government decided we've gone out far enough, we're not going to, these tangential people that may have been contacted, where there might have been competition for among the people who are trying to sell the property. In other words, is it your view that there's a wider conspiracy, or not the right word, but a wider scheme, and you cut back, and that reduced the kind of competition that you're looking for?
Sure, certainly there was a broader nature to the scheme. The government focused only on a subset of the transactions, so I would agree with that, yes. I want to touch base next on the loss to HUD briefly. So HUD sells these properties to not-for-profits at a discount of anywhere from 10 to 30%. Now, the discount doesn't come with no strings attached. These properties have to be sold to low- to moderate-income buyers who intend to live in the properties. That's the benefit of the bargain. That's what HUD is giving up in exchange for the discount. It's to further this overall goal of affordable housing. The defendants essentially hijacked this program because they used a non-for-profit organization as a nominee. So they were able to get the discount, and the evidence at trial was very clear that they didn't sell these properties to non-for-profit organization. They didn't sell the properties to low- to moderate-income buyers who intended to live in them. They sold them to investors. As a result, HUD suffered a loss. They made false statements to HUD to induce it to give this discount, and HUD didn't get the benefit of the bargain because these properties weren't sold to low- to moderate-income buyers who intended to live in them.
But okay, they lose a benefit, the benefit of helping, you know, low-income people, which is, but that has to be monetized, doesn't it?
And I think the fair way to monetize it was the value of the discount. That was what the government calculated. So if they got a 10% discount, that was what the government's position was on the loss. And we added up all those discounts, and it came to approximately $150,000 was the total amount of discounts that HUD provided. Because if these defendants were going to sell these properties to investors...
Okay, so what you're saying is that HUD buys something of value to it with a discount, buys opportunities for these poor people. So that's it. That's what it buys. And presumably the value is equal to the discount in some sense. And you're saying that they took away this value, and so HUD got nothing for its discount.
Correct.
That's
fair. Was there a straw purchaser, though?
The nominee, Westwood, the nonprofit organization, purchases it.
Purchases the whole organization.
Purchases the house right. from HUD. These are HUD foreclosed.
Right, homes. Right, I understand that.
Then it is sold to a straw, I don't know if it's a straw buyer because this person did actually buy the property, but someone who's been fraudulently.
Well, my point was to follow up on Judge Posner's, where does the loss occur?
The loss occurs when the non-for-profit buys it at a discount because they should have to pay full price for the property because they're selling it to an investor at the end of the day. They're not selling it to someone who is a low to moderate income buyer.
But second, when the transaction took place, did they qualify and then conducted the fraud later?
HUD was defrauded at the time that the property was purchased from HUD. By the non-for-profit. The non-for-profit then sells the property to one of these buyers that Brunt and Sculler recruited and that they fraudulently qualified for a huge markup, even though they've put no money in the property. They're getting the proceeds from the lender, and then they're using that property to do cosmetic rehabs on the properties. But our position is HUD was defrauded on the front end.
So you're saying the property doesn't end up with the low-income people?
No, it ends up being sold to an investor, sometimes people buying more than one of these from Westwood, the not-for-profit. I mean, I don't think it's that much different than, you know, the Sorich case at this court, which I cited in the government's brief, or these minority-backed enterprise frauds where you sort of say this company is being run by a minority business owner when it's not. This court has found there to be loss in those circumstances. It's equally applicable in this case.
Let me ask you about another loss, the other loss issue, which is disturbing. This is the business of the refinancing. So suppose you have a situation, someone gets a $100,000 loan. It's all fraudulent. Bank is careless and so on. It's got a $100,000 loan. And the house is worth only $60,000. So right there you would have a $40,000 loss. But it's the bubble, and actually this person is able to refinance. He's never going to be able to pay it off or anything, but he refinances it for $110,000. And then eventually the house is sold and it's worth only $60,000. So you're arguing, I take it, that the loss is $50,000.
Correct.
Yet the defrauders, the defendants, they don't know what's going to happen to this property in the future. They know that the loan is fraudulent. They know the property is worth much less. But they don't know what the owner is going to do So how can that be a loss attributable to – I mean, you could say the loss is attributable to the buyer getting the refinancing and the refinancier, the bank that is willing to take on a debt of $110,000 is careless or maybe dishonest, you know, like the Fremont Bank, famously dishonest. And how is that attributable to these people?
Well, I think in this case, on the facts of this case, the government specifically alleged and proved that these buyers were victims of the scheme.
Oh, so, sure. No, I understand. But, the buyer, they're suckers. But they do get this refinancing. And the bank that refinances the loan, it's like musical chairs, it ends up with a loss because the foreclosure just yields the $60,000. It's lost $50,000. But has it lost it because of the original fraud or because of its own carelessness in making this $110,000 loan to property that isn't worth it?
Well, I think in this case, it's lost it because these defendants put these buyers in this situation where they could not afford to pay these properties off. So these buyers were, first, they were lied to when Brunt and Sculler told them, if you buy this, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z to rehab the property. They were fraudulently qualified for loans, and then they were sold these properties based on inflated purchase prices. At that point, these defendants knew it was reasonably foreseeable to them.
That sounds like the whole bubble period, however.
Yeah. Right.
Fair enough. But, I mean, these defendants, it was reasonably foreseeable to them that these individuals were not going to be able to pay these mortgages.
But they couldn't foresee, no one could foresee the, the trajectory of the bubble. So they don't, how could they know that this, the sucker who got the $100,000 loan, is going to be able to refinance? I mean, I think they think the opposite. They say, oh, you know, we got this sucker. We've got him to pay $100,000 and got him the loan because he didn't have any money, so he gets it. But can they infer from this initial transaction that he's going to be able to refinance it at a higher rate?
Not necessarily. And that's why when the government calculated the loss and refinance, it didn't include the higher refinance property price. So if the property was sold to this buyer for $100,000, and if it was worth, and I apologize, I may have answered your question wrong before, it was sold to them at $100,000, and then it was ultimately sold for $60,000. The government's position is it's a $40,000 loss. If that buyer refinanced it for $120,000, the government didn't include that additional $20,000 because I think arguably it would not be foreseeable to them about the increase.
Then I've misunderstood. I thought that was what the defendants were.
No, their argument.
What is their?
Their argument is that the refinance property shouldn't count at all. That essentially there's been an intervening act, and that there should be no loss attributable to them for these transactions. And if you look, the one buyer who testified about how she was able to refinance, I think provides a really good, really good evidence as to why these defendants shouldn't get the benefit of it. This buyer testified that she put her own money into the property, she found her own tenants to live in the property, and that she refinanced to try and lower her mortgage payments so she could make the payments on the loan. She ultimately was not able to do so, but I don't think, certainly not under plain error, I don't think that her efforts should be served to benefit these defendants because they're the ones that put her in this position to begin with.
But in my example, if I change my example, so... The house is worth $60,000 when the defendants make the arrange for a $100,000 loan, but later it's sold for $80,000. So then, would you say the loss was $20,000?
Correct. Right. That's how we.
So you're just looking at the final price of the house when it's sold.
Correct.
And that fixes the loss.
Correct. We did not, to the extent on these refinance properties, we did not take the increased refinance value
right,
and subtract
okay,
that from the
result. I didn't understand that.
With respect, I think I will rest on what I've said already, Your Honors, unless there is an issue that you would like me to cover that I have not covered.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you,
Your
Honors.
So do any of you wish additional I think one of you ran out of time, but whoever that was can have a little more time too. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. LaPalma, I mean.
Thank you, Judge. I'll be brief. Judge, I want to address your question is what difference does it make? What difference does the joinder make? And I'll do my best to take a crack at it again. And you gave the hypothetical, if Brunt made a deal with the government and he testified for the government, what's the difference? And I think the practical impact is the difference here. The government, first of all, after debriefing Brunt, which it did in this case, they would have made a determination what to introduce in the trial. And they certainly would not have sought to introduce prejudicial, unfairly prejudicial evidence and irrelevant evidence. So right there is the first filter. The government wouldn't have tried to introduce everything Brunt did. The second thing is, if the government thought it was probative.
But if the government is worse off because Brunt testified, then your client is better off.
Well, I don't think
you get a very vulnerable accuser who's a co-defendant.
I do.
The government won't vouch for him. In fact, the government tells the jury's liar in some respects. Please.
Judge, I do believe we would have been in a better position if Brunt was a witness for the government rather than sitting on our side of the courtroom. Judge, if I could just.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Judge, the other point is this. If the government thought what Brunt had to say was probative, it would have filed a motion with the district court, which would have led to briefing and argument. It would have led to a decision by the court and an analysis by the court. And the court would have said that evidence is excluded, or which we would be arguing, or that evidence is going to be admissible at trial. So we have these different layers of filters going on here. And we would be, with the practical effect, judges, we would be prepared. We would be able to mount a defense and be prepared for the allegations that are being thrown at us weeks in advance of the trial rather than during the trial as it's coming into the courtroom. And on top of that, Judge, the most important point of all is the jury would not have heard all of this unfairly prejudicial and irrelevant evidence. That's the
like
effect.
The racial thing, you mean?
The racial thing, Judge, the 72nd Street, the McDermott thing. There's quite a few which are laid out in our brief. The forgery that Murphy supposedly did, the multiple forgery stops, all irrelevant, Judge. And especially, Judge, when you consider it in a 9-week trial, when the jury had been told it was going to be a 5-week trial. And at the end, we're being rushed through our defense. And the bottom line, Judge, is Brunt's testimony benefited the government. And how do I know that? I know that because the prosecutor told Judge Guzman that at a sidebar.
Were there any financially experienced people on the jury?
Judge, it would require us – I don't think it's in the record, but I know a lot of the jurors during selection were asking to be excused given the length of the trial.
Even when it was just 5 weeks?
Even when it was just 5 weeks, Judge. Yeah.
Well, what you lose are small business people.
You lose the people who have day-to-day responsibilities right. With employment, Judge.
The guy that runs a gas station or the whatever.
Yes, Judge, certainly.
Following up on Judge Kenney's question, would you lose an executive of a large company or would he be required to serve because, unlike the case of the small businessman, you know, the business isn't going to collapse because he isn't there.
Judge, people were coming in with hardship requests, and Judge Guzman was not willy-nilly excusing them. He was actually putting them through, filtering them with questions.
Right.
But quite often, Judge, the people who did have day-to-day responsibilities, including the people who ran businesses, for instance, were excused from the jury. And the bottom line with respect to all this, Judge, after 9 weeks, the prosecutor stood up in front of the government and said, we credit Pajan and Brunt because they helped us make our case against Murphy. And so on top of it all, the government's vouching for Brunt's testimony. And I have more on leadership. I see my time is up, and I apologize into that issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Abdullah. Mr. Martin?
Your Honor, I was the one that ran out of time, but if I could respectfully have 1 minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Sure.
Just on the severance point, the government got up here and told the court that Brunt was not telling the truth. These are ethical prosecutors, and if they knew their witness, if Brunt was a government witness, was not telling the truth, they would not have put him on. Turning to the leadership, Mr. Ferrano did not organize this scheme. The flipping of properties in the Englewood section of the city of Chicago was going on long before Mr. Ferrano got involved. The facts the government relies upon for leadership are more reminiscent of the use of a special skill, his education of his lawyer, as a lawyer, his ability to put together these documents, and use of sophisticated means. Sophisticated means applied in this case. We're not contesting it. If the leadership didn't apply, then special skill likely would apply. Finally, the government has...
Is there one person or more than one who thought up this general scheme? You know, sort of ingenious, dealing with HUD, the nonprofit intermediary, and so on.
It was not Mr. Ferrano. Mr. Brunt was the one who got the buyers together.
I understand, but I'm just saying, who thought of the scheme, right? It's an ingenious scheme. So is this something like everybody knows that you do things like that, or did someone come up with this idea that if we use the nonprofit as an intermediary, you know, we could get all this money from HUD?
Only if you deal with the government.
Well, the ones who thought of the scheme were not defendants. It would have been Capital Acquisition, Stan Samagula, and John McLinn, who were Mr. Ferrano became partners with them. It didn't last long, and then he got out. But he didn't think of that. Finally, the government doesn't point to a person that Mr. Ferrano controlled. You can't say on this record Mr. Ferrano controlled Mr. Brunt. Mr. Brunt, the mere rehabber, the mere I didn't own any properties, he received, it's undisputed, $819,000 off these closing statements. And Mr. Ferrano, in comparison, received $257,000.
Well, his income, he would get that and not spend that in the rehab. And,
correct.
In other words, get $100,000 and spend $50,000.
Well, in many instances, he didn't even spend the $50,000 because he didn't do the rehab at all. But he received 300% more than Mr. Ferrano, who received 4 points.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Mullins?
Thank you. Mr. Brunt testified for, I believe, 2 or 3 days. And from those 2 or 3 days of testimony, the government, in its argument here, pointed out or picked out Mr. Brunt's testimony about the appraisals as an example of Mr. Brunt, of the testimony that was not truthful. So the testimony about the appraisals was essential to the case. The testimony against Mr. Brunt in this respect came almost entirely from Walter Jackson. So any evidence that would discredit Walter Jackson's testimony was essential to Brunt's defense, and that's why not allowing Mr. Brunt to cross-examine Mr. Jackson with his confession to the police violated his right to confront Mr. Jackson.
No. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Mullins. Mr. Garst?
Thank you, Your Honors. 2 points. First, the government, in talking about HUD and the loss to HUD, said that it had to be monetized, and the fair way to monetize would be adding up the discounts. It's still our position that even if you monetize that way, that would be an intended loss, not actual loss. If the government wanted to put in evidence, which I do not believe anywhere in their brief, if they pointed to anywhere at trial.
I don't understand the difference. What he argued was interesting, was that HUD for the discount buys something, buys a product that's valuable to it, namely providing affordable housing to low-income people. And what the defendants did was take away this benefit, so they get the discount, but the government gets nothing for its discount. It was supposed to get low-income housing, doesn't get it. So, in effect, it's like their discount is stolen, right?
Well, we're not contesting that their policies, you know, were not followed.
No. The point is, this is money. They give a discount. They're giving away money. And they're buying something for it. They think they're buying something. They think they're buying, you know, opportunities for low-income people to have housing. And they're getting nothing for it because it's not going to those people. So they've lost their money. Their discount was stolen from them, right?
I would disagree with respect to that it was a loss of money because it wasn't like HUD was trying to sell these properties for the higher amount. This was the price.
They offer the discount to try to get to try to get low-income housing because obviously it's going to generate less rental and so on. So they offer the discount and they're buying a commodity. It's an unusual commodity. A commodity is low-income houses, a charitable commodity of some sort. redistributive commodity. But it is a commodity. It's something they're paying for, and they're not getting it. Right? And that's like theft. Right? I mean, suppose, for example, I sold you a fancy outfit, and I gave you a 10% discount, and I said, look, this is my best dress, so I want you to wear it at all the parties you go to. And then you're advertising my product. And instead, you take it and you sell it to someone in Paris. So I get no advertising, and that's what I was trying to buy with the discount. Isn't that our case?
Well, that's assuming that HUD was trying to buy these things, these nonprofits, with the discount. If you were offering that dress for 10% to me and another woman or man who walked in and wanted that dress, then you're not really giving me a discount. You're giving me the sale price. And that's what we're saying for HUD. They were offering this same sale price. Well, the problem is with what happened afterwards.
They had a targeted audience. They wanted low-income families to buy these properties. As part of the general policy, if they could sell it for the higher price, they would. But that was part of the, if I can recall, 10 years ago, whenever this was at its zenith, it was to promote low-income housing and seen as a way to avoid building the kind of thing that happened in the 60s and 70s.
Correct. The problem that we foresee is that it was offered to everyone at the same amount. What happened later, yes, there was intended a loss. But the actual loss, if there really was an actual loss to HUD, there should have been some evidence put forward by the government from HUD. They had a HUD witness on the stand. They didn't ask her anything about loss. They didn't ask her to explain, you know, even in a group of properties, how does this work? When are these properties available to the public? What would be your loss?
Well, HUD, I get back more fundamentally, where the money came from to pay for the discount. And it didn't come out of thin air. It came from taxpayers, right?
If they ever expected to get the full price.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms.
Thank
Carlos.
You, Your Honor.
And were all of the defendant's lawyers appointed? Ms. Garst?
She was discounted.
Okay. Well, we particularly thank you, Ms. Garst, for accepting the appointment, but we thank the other lawyers for their very good job, and we certainly thank the U.S. Attorney for excellent argument. So.